Please be seated. Somewhere in the 12-hour span between the very last day of fifth grade summer and the very first day of sixth grade school, the developmental earth moves. And so it was for me. Not really for me, because it happens for boys much later than it happens for girls on average. But I remember emerging into that sixth grade classroom and feeling a tension that I hadn't felt before. Now, to be clear, if there are two kinds of teachers, if we were to make a gross overstatement or generalization about the kind of teachers we inherit, if there were two kinds of teachers, one who is soft and nurturing and open and forgiving, and another who is stern and hard and demanding and unforgiving, I happen to draw the stern one in the sixth grade. And what we felt immediately upon entering Mrs. Paulus's classroom is that the beautiful, creative, full-voiced spirit that was emerging in the adolescent girls in my class met with some significant resistance to Mrs. Paulus's stern approach to classroom and student management. There is one particular instance that I will never forget. It moved the earth for me in such a way that it called into question the existential view that I carried thus far forward in life, from zero or those first very beginnings of thoughts of our own being through that very day. And it happened in an exchange between an incredibly bright classmate of mine named Britt. Britt was a bright, dynamic, creative young woman who was an early adopter of like the punk rock haircut in the 1980 Reagan era days of my childhood. She was always pushing the edge in such a beautiful and full-voiced way. And I was a scholarship kid at a sort of fancy pants private school. And by virtue of that school's culture, all of the students, the male students, wore khaki pants and a white shirt, and the female students wore either a plaid skirt or a red skirt and a white shirt. And the culture, the conventional culture of the school itself, did not embody a spirit of personal expression. Until one morning, Britt arrived to our classroom, which Mrs. Paulus had an iron hand on, in a pair of high-heeled, red, patent leather, Fiorucci boots. Now, to be clear, these boots were in no way a violation of the dress code. There was nothing about the shoes that you could wear. There was plenty about the skirt that you could wear and the length of said skirt. There was plenty about even the socks that we boys could wear if we happened to wear shorts. But nowhere did it say anything about footwear. And Britt pranced into our classroom in these absolutely dynamite red boots. And immediately, Mrs. Paulus went to 100. There was a clash of titans that began in that classroom this day that I remember. And honestly, like, Britt was right. And when Miss Paula said she could either change those shoes into her socks or some other shoes, or she could go to the principal, Britt replied with the reply that most of us would. She said, "Mrs. Paulus, that is not fair." And she was right. And then Mrs. Paulus delivered a line that turned my world upside down. She said, "Britt, life is not fair." That shook me to the core. Because if I'm being honest, from the time I can remember until that very moment in time, I had been earnestly devoted to tamping down my eagerness and waiting for my turn on the water slide. I had earnestly worked to divide the Snickers bar to the millimeter in a perfectly carved 2 equal half sessions. I had devoted myself to going to the birthday parties of everyone in my class, not just those classmates that I loved and adored. Everything that had been a rule or a measure of my life was measured under the measurement of fairness. It was the idea, I lived under the idea that I would get mine and you would get yours. And that's how we would move forward in life together. So when Mrs. Paulus said life is not fair, it turned my world upside down. If life was not fair, then what was it, I wondered to myself? Then what is life meant to be? If we turn our attention to the teaching of Luke's Jesus over the course of the last several weeks, and I mean from the beginning of the 15th chapter of Luke's gospel through the 16th chapter and into the 17th chapter, Jesus begins to create a kerygma, a teaching about just what drives our living together. And we have paid careful attention to the course of those stories over the course of the last few weeks. You don't have to have been here in order to pick up what I'm trying to lay down this morning. Let me backtrack a little bit. If you know the 15th chapter of Luke's gospel, you know that there are 3 primary stories Jesus tells, and they are a triptych. They are all related one to another. They cannot be divided. They should be told as one full story, and each story builds on the other. The very first story is told that there was a shepherd who entrusts his flock of 99 into the care of those brilliant, beautiful, tall, white dogs. I don't know what kind of breed of dog that is, but if you have spent time backpacking in the Wind Rivers and you come across those sheep herds that roam that range, you see those white dogs keeping the herd together. The good shepherd abandons the sheep to the care of those white dogs in order to go find the one that has been lost. The shepherd travels over hill and dale until he encounters that sheep. And when he does, he lifts that sheep up over and bears that sheep on his shoulders and returns him to the community of the 99. It is a beautiful, generous, merciful move that shakes up our understanding about what we as human beings, particularly those in the ranching business, think is prudent. The second story is about an old woman who loses a coin somewhere in her apartment. Now, the assumption that we make is she likely has many other coins, but she turns her apartment upside down in order to find that one lost coin. And when she does, she with great joy celebrates the encounter, the re-encounter with the coin. And she does something that we human beings think is a little crazy. What we're meant to hear in the story is that she is so exuberant to be reunited with this particular lost coin that she goes and spends it in a great celebration in the reconnection and the restoration of her relationship with that coin. And we human beings, under the fairness model or the prudence model, are like, what? Like, why would you go spend the coin when you had lost it and you did all that work to find it? And she does it because of the joy that she feels. And then the third beat of that story is the story that we know is the story of the prodigal son. Man, this may be one of the most gorgeous stories in all of sacred text. It tells the tenderest story of a demanding, self-centered, even cruel younger son who comes to his father and says, "Dad, give me my inheritance. I have no need of you. I have no need of this family and all that it has meant in my upbringing." The father generously supplies his son with the resource that he would inherit. The son travels off and squanders that wealth in moves of both malevolent and careless exuberance. At the lowest point in his life, he returns to his senses. Now, to be clear, he doesn't return to his senses expecting a moment of generosity. He just returns to that fairness model where he's like, man, this is terrible. Having nothing in a place where there is nothing and I am afforded nothing, it would be better for me to go back home and work for my dad, not to live in the house, but to live in the bunkhouse, not to eat at the family table, but to eat at the table of the other ranch hands. And that's what I intend to do. And as the story is told across that turn that the son makes, it has its most graceful and generous moment when it gives us the detail while he was still a long way off. The father spied his son on the road and ran out to greet him. And in that moment that they are reconciled, reconnected one to another, the father does three things. The first thing he does is he gives his son a robe. He restores his son's personal dignity. The second thing he does is even more profound. He gives him a ring. He restores his son to the family. You will not be one of my hired hands. You are my beloved child. And then the third thing is the most beautiful and courageous move a parent can ever make. He gives him sandals. He gives him keys to a ranch truck. He says, "Son, I am so glad you are restored to me, but you are free to come or to go." It is a gorgeous story. All of those three stories up until that point in the story itself are about God's orientation to humanity, this orientation of grace, this orientation of forgiveness, this orientation of mercy. And then Luke's Jesus begins to shift our attention in this kerygma that he is delivering us in the encounter that begins with the elder child, right? The elder child comes to his father and he's like, "Dad, man, what? This is not fair." The father responds, "Of course it's not fair. Why would we be fair when we can be merciful and forgiving and loving?" And then he comes to that elder son. I imagine if the elder son doesn't resist, he puts his head on his breast or his shoulder, and he says, "Dear one, dear one, all that is mine is yours." Luke's Jesus begins to teach you and me about how we orient ourselves in human relationship. That's the close of the 15th chapter. The opening of the 16th chapter is what we had last week, if you were around this place. You heard the bishop preach a sermon about this parable that we have about a shrewd manager. It's about a guy who basically has done either a mediocre job or a poor job at embodying his vocation and looking after the resources of his master. And his master comes to him and says, like, "Hey, man, I'd like to meet on Friday and get a sense of, like, where we are on the P&Ls so we know how to move forward in the coming quarter." And the guy kind of freaks out a little bit, right? So he goes back to all those who owe debts to his master. And he says, like, "Okay, how much do you owe?" And they're like, "I owe 100. And he's like, "Okay, give me 50 and we're cool." And he's like, "How much do you owe?" And he's like, "I owe 120. He's like, "Okay, give me 80 and then we're good." And then he makes these deals with all these people. He brings the resource together. He comes to his master, of course, expecting that he's going to be called onto the carpet, right? Because what was supposed to be whole is really about two-thirds. But when he meets his master with the two-thirds, his master replies from a place of generosity, from a place of mercy. He says, "Well done. Great job. I never expected to get the whole portion. Two-thirds. Awesome. We're good." It is Luke's Jesus teaching us that humanity can be merciful in all of humanity's interactions, including commerce. What a notion. What a notion. And that in that merciful stance, we all might benefit in a beautiful way. And then we come upon this story that we have today. It's the final parable in a beat of five. And it can be a confusing one, and I should say, like, right from the get-go, this is one of those stories that always makes Episcopalians very nervous. We, for the most part, as a whole, not individually, but as a whole, tend to be fairly well-resourced and really well-educated. And so when you tell a story about a rich guy who goes to hell and a poor guy who goes to heaven, Episcopalians begin to shake a little bit in the pews, you know? But this is not a story about a poor guy who goes to heaven and a rich guy who goes to hell. Let me assure you of that. This idea that the things that you do in your life somehow cast you to a place where you have no relationship with God is anathema to Luke's Jesus. Let me remind you, it is Luke's Jesus who says, while he is hanging on the cross, "Father, forgive them, because they have no consciousness around the depth and terror and violence of their actions. And because they have no consciousness of that, they are meant to be included in your loving forgiveness." What are we meant to hear in a story about a poor man named Lazarus and a rich man who is unnamed? I believe that the core of the teaching here for us is that humanity, in all of our relating one to another, makes mistakes. We human beings make mistakes. And what Luke's Jesus is seeking to teach us is the particular kind of mistakes that we make as human beings that are incredibly pernicious and lead us to a place of distance one from another. If you consider the kind of mistakes that we make as human beings, the ones that appear to be the most dangerous are the ones that happen like outside of our consciousness. The ones that happen because we're just not paying attention. It's not like the one where we're like, "I'm gonna punch that guy in the mouth and he's gonna lose a tooth because he deserves it." It's not that kind of mistake, though that's most certainly a mistake. It's a mistake that happens because we are just careless to the needs and desires and maybe even presence of another beloved. Luke's Jesus is teaching us that in order for us to embody life in the way that God is directing us, we must pay attention. All across the wisdom scriptures, there's language around attending. We talk about in wisdom traditions, we talk about the orientation of being awake or of being enlightened or of being present to the present moment or of being mindful. This is the teaching that Luke's Jesus is seeking to have land in our own hearts and in our own lives. That as we attend to our lives day in and day out, our focus should be both on the reception of grace and forgiveness that comes into our own lives and the extension that might be delivered from our own hearts and our own experiences. Now, in a moment of vulnerability and in transparency, let me say clearly and definitively to this church, John, Paul, George, Ringo, and Travis. Almost get it right. All we need is love. All we need is love. It has its beautiful resonance. But the tradition delivers us a model of virtue that is important for us to understand. Love Thomas Aquinas says, is a theological virtue. It is a virtue that humanity doesn't gin up on our own. It is simply a gift from God and the seventh heaven into our very beings. Aquinas goes on to teach us about cardinal virtues. These are virtues where we do have human agency, where we can use our talents and our resources, our minds, our hearts to gin up goodness. And the balancing virtue of fairness, the balancing virtue of justice is mercy. Love that we receive from God must then be cultivated and transformed into merciful orientation so that we might deliver mercy to humanity while we interact here on the ground, while we're living and breathing and doing. Life isn't fair. Life isn't fair. Thank God, life isn't fair. If that is true, then what is it meant to be? It's meant to be merciful. Mercy that we receive and mercy that we embody and we share. No matter the color of your wool, if your wool is the whitest of white or the inkiest of black or somewhere in between, my prayer is that at some point in your life, you experience the feeling of being carried, in the same way that I am now in this very moment, in this very season of my own life. I also hope that you experience being carried in such a profound and loving way that in all that you say and all that you do and all that you are, you might open the eyes of your heart and be merciful. Amen.